Hi everyone, welcome back to the Singapore Noodles podcast. For those of you who are new here, Singapore Noodles is both a podcast and a newsletter that seeks to inspire and equip you to cook food from Singapore. The larger mission is to ensure that our food traditions are preserved and kept alive. And as a free subscriber to our newsletter, you'll be receiving recipes, deep dives, and new episodes straight in your inbox. If you're keen, you can sign up at sgpnoodles.substack.com. That is S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K. So today on the podcast, I'm speaking with Chef Ivan Brem, whose work in cuisine highlights the importance of interdependence and connection. Fueled by the idea that no food culture exists in isolation, Chef Ivan creates dishes at Restaurant Nuri that are enriched by the research conducted at Appetite, which is an R&D kitchen. I hope that you'll enjoy listening to this episode. Could you tell me, when did you move to Singapore and what was your first impression of the cuisine?
I moved to Singapore about 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was working in the UK at the time and I was leaving the Fat Duck where I spent about 5 years. And the process of leaving was pretty exciting because I had no idea literally where Singapore was on the map. It took me an odd second there to put my finger on it. And I came after, like I promised, I'd need to study as much as I could before arriving, because if I was going to make a move or even entertain the possibility, I needed to know what I was getting into. Mm-hmm. And I remember there's an old school Discovery Channel documentary about Singapore. And when I started seeing this, I'm like, I'm totally moving there. I'm going to make this. I loved it. It was just so good. And mm-hmm. it gave a lot of context. It was like a 6-hour special. There's several mm-hmm. episodes. It was really cool.
Prior to the move, did you have any experiences with Singaporean food?
No, none, or at least so I thought. Like, I had some experience with Peranakan food just because of being in the UK and having friends that were from Malaysia. Mm-hmm. But I never actually thought of it in that context. It was just different food for me. It was at a time where I wasn't necessarily exploring to the detail where that was from. The exciting part for me was the cultural confluence, like being in a place that is like a part of so many other traditions at the same time. It felt very invigorating and exciting. And I always had a soft spot for Asia, or curiosity for Asia. I wanted always to move this side. Mm-hmm. Since I was a teenager, something was calling me. I had like, I loved, and here is a blanket statement, Asia, right? Yeah. But I'd love that idea of just being able to be somewhere completely different and learn more. I think once you spend so much time, I was in the US for a while, I was in Europe for a while, and after a while, it kind of becomes a little bit of the same. Like the ideas are repetitive. They're always rooted in very similar morals, and you want fresh, and Asia was very fresh, and Singapore was a very good introduction for that. So,
And your heritage is Brazilian?
I'm second generation Brazilian. So my family is from everywhere. All of them immigrants. So my mom's side of the family is Italian and Spanish, Syrian and Lebanese, and they all came to Brazil because of wars, I guess, First and Second World War. And then on my dad's side of the family, we're German and Russian, and they're also left because of World War II. And so everybody came running away from somewhere, coming to Brazil to make Brazil their nation. And but so we grew up with this really rich environment of like different foods all the time, different topics, different viewpoints. And it was always very dynamic.
Yeah.
Very stressful as well. Christmases and New Year's and all of these holidays, everybody sitting around the table having discussions and arguments. And it was actually a really cool way to learn how to balance viewpoints, you know, how to look at culture from a more comprehensive way, because I was that product, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that kind of heritage and being from coming from a very cosmopolitan country like the UK, did you feel like it made you more open to try different things in Singapore?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I came ready to absorb. I literally came with one goal in mind, which was to blank slate things, not to take anything for granted. And to be frank, 11 years on, and it's still this way. I think I'd learned a lot more from the process of trying to integrate than from a place of difference or yeah, it's really always been that position. And because of it, you end up just really integrating as well as you can, learning as much as possible. So the point was always to really be here, like wholeheartedly.
How did you find a way to truly assimilate and to find, you know, what is the more local side of the food scene? Because I think, you know, there is a very sparkly kind of image that tourists get when they come to Singapore, expats. But I think the real heartbeat of Singapore lies in the hawker centers, in the wet markets. And I think it's a very intimidating place for even locals.
Yeah, well, if you've never been caught in an argument about which one is the best Hokkien mee somewhere, then you haven't been in Singapore long enough, right? Everybody has a very specific viewpoint about their food beliefs. And food keeps the country going in some regards, right? It's very much one of the most engaging ways for people to express themselves and to entertain themselves. So, yeah, I think both realities can coexist. And one of the first things that stayed in my mind was that there were two Singapores that aren't, they are perhaps integrated for a certain amount of locals, but they're not entirely well integrated. You have the glitz and glamour, and you can live a very expensive and to some degree incredibly westernized, consumeristic kind of life, right? And it's a beautiful way of executing it. I mean, nobody does it better, to be honest. But there is a completely different context to things that are more, and I say this with pride, not any criticism, but like there's this, the kampong vibe as you start to branch out and go elsewhere, right? And you get to speak to people and just chat to somebody while he's drinking Tiger beer with ice on in a corner somewhere, and actually learn other things. And so that process for me was more important. And I think I get more out of that than I do the glitz. And so I do eat more locally and with shorts and flip-flops than I do with moccasins and jeans. And I think I'm better off for it. You end up catching conversations with uncles more. And to some degree, I think having been here for 11 years, they do start to realize that they want to be heard. Like these people want to tell their stories of how they put this whole thing together. And in some ways, how they don't necessarily recognize it at times as well, right? Like this is very much a reality that we're coexisting with. So I enjoy that process more. I think my interaction with the local food scene is a lot more that interaction than the actual restaurant world, fine dining world interaction. And in some ways, I think the restaurants that I run try to perhaps shine a light as best as they can into some of these processes, techniques, products, and also give credit where credit is due. Like to be able to talk about these things in actual good, educated light, you know, to be able to make sure that it isn't disrespectful to the culture itself, not appropriative. I'm well aware of the countless core amounts of chefs there that literally take something from somewhere and just make it their own without giving any sort of credit. So, yeah.
I remember that when I was working on Wet Market to Table a few years ago, I was having a look at your menu and I thought it was so wonderful that you featured so many ingredients from our wet markets. Was it a very intentional process?
Yeah, very much so. I think I came in with a little bit of a bone to pick. The part that we're talking about, the glitz, which it's still very much in some regards what fills my rice bowl. Right? I mean, I am a fine dining restaurant and there's no escaping that context. It's very much what my training is and where we put all of our heads to make this thing work in the most expressive and beautiful possible way. And it's not accessible. It's an expensive meal. And so knowing very well that the audience that I am trying to reach is the audience that doesn't necessarily look at these things with the same amount of value, right? And we got a lot of pushback in the beginning, and those were the Bacchanalia years, not even the Nuri years. But we had these crazy goals of like engaging dumpling makers and just featuring a dish that was actually collaborative all the time between us and a skill that was being lost, or make our own gardens popular. And we did that, right? Baka had the first real, actually to this day, I think it's the only restaurant garden in the whole of Singapore at the time. We literally grew a ton of Southeast Asian varieties of herbs specifically on grounds. And so there was always this link with what's luxury from nature, right? Mm-hmm. And to try to treat the like a wild pepper leaf and a tin of caviar with the same level of care and respect was an important conversation. But I was a little naive to imagine that everybody would see things in that way. And so the work to this day is very much still trying to have in part that conversation and putting these two things in the same pedestal, things that people recognize as like the epitome of Western luxury or Asian luxury, with products that are growing right in our garden, literally on the ground, sometimes just around the corner from where we live, with the same level of interest and respect. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's very true. What I found when I was working on the book was that I think a lot of locals view these Southeast Asian ingredients through a very fixed lens, you know, like they can only be cooked in soup or stir fries. So for you, what was your process like in trying to reimagine dishes with these very traditional ingredients?
I think because that's a wonderful question, actually. Because it was a part of the conversation. Like, there were two doors to enter that, and I didn't have the keys for the first one, which was my background isn't rooted here, right? And to be able to give them the treatment that they deserved in a cultural context, I would have had to relive my entire life here, right? And to be able to acquire all of those experiences and the taste, quote unquote, right, their essential taste. And so my first experience was quite different, was literally looking at them with blank slate eyes. I had no preconceived notion of what they were supposed to taste like, no preconceived notion about what and how they'd perform when you were cooking them and what could be done. And I acquired the key for the second one after years of being here more, and still every day is a learning process. But the first was quite easy. And I think my background at the Duck helped a lot. I mean, the last 3 years of my tenure there, I was in the lab. And part of the job was to consistently look at things with fresh eyes and with no preconceived notions, right? You want to just taste the product for its value, period, right? And so I learned that. It was a good skill to have, to be able to just taste something and literally incorporate that into our process. And I think to some degree, that's why we succeeded initially. Well, people, we offer them a new way of seeing an old thing. And that's innovation in some ways, right? When you're like breathing new life into an old thing, you're innovating. And so that part was cool. But I think what I was looking for was the key for the second door.
Yeah.
And I think more and more you get closer and closer to it. So I have also that journey to talk about now.
What kind of pushback did you receive from people when first using these ingredients?
I think you will always, and rightfully so, get a resistance from folk who recognize the foreigner, right? And that's I understand why, because I was and am, right? I am not from here. But I think my conversation has always been about closing that gap, because in some ways we all are foreigners to this place, and it's literally a question of when, not of if, right? And so I think the initial pushback eased when people realized that I was actually serious about learning from the space, like being a part of the space, having conversations with people that knew more, being respectful about the use, and studying what made it special for this place has literally been the lifesaver. It's realistically why we survived this long with such a different proposition. Has been because we're earnest about knowing things. And sometimes we get to this point where we know a lot. We yeah. get to study it so much and so deeply that sometimes we can have conversations with people about preconceived notions that they've had about their own product and culture and history mm-hmm. in a lens that's much greater and allows for broader discussions and brings other communities into the mix. And that yeah. part's been equally exciting too.
Yeah. You know, I'm surprised when you say that people actually gatekeep ingredients. Like, I normally hear of people gatekeeping recipes, but I'm surprised to hear that, that there was such a pushback. Why do you think that's the case? Do you think Singaporeans are extremely protective of their cuisine and their food culture to a fault?
No, I don't think that's it. I think it's a natural process that whenever, because we identify with our food traditions, right? Mm. That there is a certain level of possessiveness that comes with it too. Mm-hmm. And whenever somebody touches on that, I think you're touching on something that doesn't belong to you. Mm. And because food has been used for the longest time as a marker also for identity, right? I think the food of the other, like in Chinese culture, the word barbarian was always designated for food that came from outside the boundaries mm. of what the kingdoms were, right? So when you talk about it in that context, then I think it makes sense. And I wouldn't see it as dissimilar to the way a Japanese would talk about a gaijin using a Japanese ingredient, or an Italian talking about how, and that's very much a conversation like this that's happening everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. But I think to some degree our purpose as a restaurant and the point of Appetite too, so both Nuri and Appetite, the point of this entire conversation is to try to show nuance in this chat mm-hmm. of possessiveness and mm-hmm. identity, and remind people that a lot of this is kind of inflated and full of crap mm-hmm. and used for the wrong purposes. You know, when mm-hmm. when we use food literally as a border setting device there,
yeah,
we are sending a few messages, and some of them aren't entirely mm-hmm. true.
Yeah. So I think this is a theme that runs through your cuisine, which you term crossroads cuisine, and also through the work that you do at Appetite, you know, where you try to emphasize similarities or parallels between cuisines. So why do you think this has been such a big focus for you? I mean, is there a personal story behind it?
Yeah, I think there's my personal story is one. I think it was the way that I had to make sense of my own journey as a human, because my family is completely mixed. And when you start having to balance all of those under the same roof, then you're already practicing crossroads. You know, you're looking for the similarities, because grandpa and grandpa can't be too different from one another. Otherwise, your family structure makes no sense, right? As a kid, I think we learn to be diplomatic about our relationships, because diplomacy was all about Sunday lunch. Dinner at somebody's birthday was very diplomatic. It was trying to learn from people who are from completely different parts of the world. And so that has been part of my personal story for sure. But also, I think I've never had a discrimination drives me nuts, you know, like seeing people being aggressive or violent towards the other. And I like this idea of this notion of separateness, right? And identifying more with a particular thing than another is great for some things, but the moment it starts to become violent and disrespectful, then erodes this harmonious process that it is to be a human being alive with another human being right in front of him. That stuff drives me bonkers. I can't, like, it makes no sense. And for me, it's the main reason. We can talk about sustainability ecologically, for example, and I'll put the problem of our completely pillaging the world and destroying it dead smack in our issues about how we converse in society and how sustainable or unsustainable our communities are. There is no departing from there. I think for me, everything starts there, how two people meet and interact. Mm. And so the restaurant was also an exercise in trying to highlight to people that without you, there's no me, that our cultural products are very much reliant on one another.
Do you feel like the role of the chef has kind of expanded in recent years? I mean, in the past, you would never see chefs having such a platform. But I think over recent years, when we watch Chef's Table, for example, I mean, the chefs always have a perspective, or they have a mission, or they have a message that they want to drive home with the food that they serve. What do you think of this phenomenon or this change?
I think it's great, but with that power comes a lot of responsibility as well. And we're seeing the backlash now. I mean, you've seen the news, right?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of redeeming to be made for a lot of chefs out there. And so I think it's an incredibly beneficial thing in the long run, because we do have things to say, and we're literally, there's seldomly been a community around the world who's so preoccupied with just pleasing people. Mm-hmm. Right, like our whole purpose of being is to just keep the social fabric tight by just offering them a space to enjoy themselves and be communal, right? And we feed them, and all of that's a very nurturing kind of engagement. And it, obviously, there will be a lot of strong opinions about things that we're doing as humans. And so, I'd love the fact that the platform is there. I don't necessarily enjoy the fact that at times the platform seems to kidnap some of that message for its own sake. And so it's very easy to see chefs lose track of what they're doing and put the success of their endeavor ahead of the endeavor itself. I think that backlash is hidden strong, and I welcome it. I think it's a really good time for some house cleaning. Now the vehicles of communication are much broader. Like before, the role of a chef ended in the dish they serve to a guy who could potentially be a Michelin inspector, for example. Mm-hmm. But right now we're talking to everybody at the same time at all times, sometimes without them even trying our food. We're having a conversation about ideas, and we're dishing ideas up now instead of plates of food sometimes. Like, this conversation is an example of that, right?
Exactly. So can you tell me about the motivating factor behind expanding Nuri into Appetite? What exactly is Appetite?
Appetite is the research arm of Nuri. And the goal was to create a space where we could have those conversations slightly separate from the restaurant. Just from an efficiency standpoint, it was very difficult to maintain the day-to-day operation and do research. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of literally needed a more physical space and decided to create a business on the side of it to help pay for it, because research costs money. There's no other way of putting it. We pay like 2 to 3 full-time members of staff consistently to just be there and curate artworks, curate research, write stuff, gather volunteer work. And all of that costs, and all of that from the spoils of literally one, now two F&B places. And so Appetite was a way to formalize that arrangement, to give it some structure. Our great focus from a simple Nuri standpoint is food. And so we do historical analysis and anthropological analysis on the origin of dishes and in the ways that we eat, the rituals around them, and trying to consistently identify where is it that different communities have met. And the research is really focused on those little intersection points there.
How does the research at Appetite inform the day-to-day kind of operations of Nuri?
The food specifically is the result of that work. We try to create dishes that highlight the findings of the research in a creative way. And so an example would be, one of our signatures has been on the menu for the longest time, which is a Brazilian fritter that is served with a curry that when studied, highlight the intersection between South America and Southeast Asia through Portugal, moving ingredients back and forward. The reason why local food is the way that it is in some ways connected to the reasons why Brazilian food is the way that it is. And I'm from Brazil, so I could speak about that with that familiar side of property. And so a dish like this is literally true in both of these places and highlights how similar our food traditions are. Or we could talk, like, on the new menu, we're doing a dish that talks about the history of sushi being outside of Japan, which is a great shock for everybody. We joke that sushi is Singapore's national dish. the history of that dish has its roots right at the Mekong Delta and the birthplaces of wet growing rice conditions. So, and the movement of that technique and these ingredients eastwards literally taught the Japanese how to make nara sushi, which is the OG sushi, and then edamame sushi after that. And so these are the ways, for example, that we would present it. And the goal is not to make like a dish that's historically accurate, like that is a recipe of 1,000 years ago. That's not the goal. The goal is to use that knowledge to make a dish that is like present and current and relevant today, but paying homage to all of that lineage, because the belief is that if both you and I can connect with an element of that lineage, then we're also connecting, right? We're making that journey together. And that's the way that the research is used in the restaurant. For appetite, the research is used really in a more comprehensive way that includes food, but isn't just about food. It's about people and thoughts and ideas. And so we have like an incredible series of salons and masterclasses and workshops. We have rotating art exhibitions that change every 3 to 6 months, and a pretty strong music program. And all of those bits are the result of our research into those areas too.
Yeah, it sounds like there is nothing in Singapore that is like what you're doing right now at Appetite or at Nuri even. Why do you think such a space is so necessary? And why do you think Singaporeans are ripe for something like that?
I think the world is ripe for that. I think that level of difficulty that we have here, I'd find everywhere, because people generally don't want to turn to second page, right? Everybody's somewhat comfortable with their manicured version of their traditions. Right, it's easy for us to assume that things are from here, and my grandmother makes this better than no one, and it's been like this forever, I guess. Right, and so I do the work partially because I think it's necessary. Like, I think it's a story that needs telling, and I'm old enough now to not be so daisy eyed and imagine that we're gonna change the world and systems for generations to come. But I feel like if we're having this conversation, at least we're adding an alternative viewpoint to our versions of what traditions are and who we are as people. And maybe that is a necessary bit. So I also think Singapore is in a privileged position for these conversations, because it is a new country that's still trying to find its ground, you know, trying to understand where and who it's from and what it's about. And to date, those conversations, I've been here for 11 years, are still very much in their infancy. And you're also so strategically positioned. It's so cool to be in a place that's literally been under the influence of so many different cultures. It's so far ranging as well.
Yeah, but do you think Singaporeans actually know what a gift it is to have that kind of food heritage?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. In the same way that I don't think most Italians know what a gift their food is, you know, I think we're the last 100 years have been really all about removing from people the right to their own history in some ways. Like, we're presented with a manicured version of it. And that's everywhere. Like, if you go to Turkey, it's the same. You know, everywhere that you go, we've stuck with this idea of what our identity is supposed to be like. And these are the foods that we eat. These are our national dishes. And so our job now, and I think you're doing that from what I've seen and heard too, is to kind of remind people that there's a lot more comprehension to this story and a lot more, communities. How do you say this in English? Sorry. A lot more communities around there that perhaps need a voice, that need to be represented and heard, and their work that was perhaps pilfered in the past could now be addressed and acknowledged. And so I think I wouldn't say that the country is aware of it to some degree as a whole. I think individuals are, but that's why the work's so important.
So one last question for you. How do you think Singaporeans can actually keep traditions alive and going?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think tradition only remains alive when it's relevant. And when it stops being relevant, it becomes heritage. And heritage has a very important role to play, but generally it's a museum fixture. It needs acknowledgement just for its maintenance as that fixture, you know, this thing that our forefathers used to do that in some ways feels awkward and doesn't necessarily gel with wherever it is that we're living. And I think I always like to use this example when talking about tradition, because if you see the way that if you go to a Catholic church today and you see a guy just strumming on a guitar, some Roxy tune, he's keeping the Christian tradition alive by appropriating relevant kind of modes of expression of our time, right? And so I think that's the way to keep tradition alive. It's consistently to reinvent it without its spirit being lost, right? And I'm not Christian specifically, but the example is very fitting. I think the moment that we hold to tradition and grab it like a bird, we don't want it to go away, we kill it. Like that process is stifling. And so while it's important for us to acknowledge where we're from and what we've eaten up until this point, the moment we try to preserve that in its exact 200-year-old way, we kill it. The process has to be one of consistent reinvigoration, reappropriation, renegotiation. And when that is happening, tradition is very alive, right? Mm-hmm. It's super relevant for where it is. It incorporates the Indian hen cooking Hokkien mee and the Chinese hen folding paratha. It throws all of that into the mix to make itself consistently new and yet old. That's how I think we can pay tradition forward. Trying to say this is not how you do this thing is the way to kill it, in my mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I feel that, you know, sometimes there's just too much gatekeeping. I mean, it's great that Singaporeans feel so much pride for our food, but I think sometimes gatekeeping can kill the cuisine, or to, you know, it sometimes intimidates a lot of young people from even wanting to attempt the cuisine.
I agree.
So I think it's fantastic what you're doing, and, you know, all the research that you've been doing at Appetite. I think it's very illuminating. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight conversing with you, and I hope to see you soon.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You've been listening to Chef Ivan Brim of Nuri and Appetite. If you'd like to receive future podcast episodes, deep dives, and recipes for Singaporean dishes straight in your inbox, you can sign up for the Singapore Noodles newsletter at sgpnoodles.substack.com. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you in the next episode.